Hi, I'm Fred Schonenberg, and thank you for joining me on the Venture Fuel podcast. At Venture Fuel, we help companies find new solutions by partnering with the best startups from around the world. On the show, you'll learn the secrets of business leaders who tap into startups and the founders driving extraordinary results. We'll consider new ideas, stretch our mindsets beyond the status quo, and in the process, discover how to leap the competition and fuel personal growth. On today's show, I am speaking with Mauro Porcini, the Chief Design Officer at PepsiCo. With his design team, he has won more than 1,100 design and innovation awards. And personally, he's been recognized with awards such as Fortune's 40 Under 40, Fast Company's 50 Most Influential Designers, Most Creative People in Business, and GQ's 30 Best Dressed Men, among many others. In fact, in 2018, Mauro was recognized with knighthood by the President of the Italian Republic. PepsiCo is the largest food and beverage company in North America and the second largest in the world, with revenue of more than $70 billion, close to 300,000 employees. Today, we're going to talk about how Mauro infuses design thinking into Pepsi's culture, how he is leading a new approach to innovation by design, and how he hopes to inspire the future. So let's get after it. Mauro, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
So you're definitely our first guest who has been knighted. So before we begin, can you tell us a little bit what that experience was like to be knighted?
Well, of the many honors that I was lucky to receive in my life, probably that's the most relevant, the most important, mostly because it comes from your country, the country where you're born, the country that shaped your culture, especially at the beginning of my journey. Then I left the country and moved to the United States. But so to be considered a representative of the culture, somebody that is embodying the culture and is an ambassador of the culture in the world, is such an honor and is such a responsibility as well. And it's something that I really love.
That's amazing. So just to level set the listeners a little bit, can you describe your role at Pepsi? Obviously, it's a very unique position within the organization.
Well, I am the chief design officer, and is a role that you don't find in many corporations. It's something pretty new in the business world. You may define the role in many different ways. Pragmatically, my responsibility is the one of understanding where the future is going, where the society is going in the future, and where PepsiCo is going with the society, what role the company will play in the future, and therefore what the portfolio of products and brands of this company will be in the future, both new ones, all to be imagined, invented, produced, and launched in the market, as well as the existing one that need to evolve with the evolution of the society. So this is what, on paper, we do as designers. We imagine the future and we design the future in partnership, in collaboration with the marketing functions, the R&D functions. But then if you want to really understand what we do that is unique, that is different, the reason why you need these designers in these companies today, and today more than ever, is that essentially your designers are nothing else than what I call the ambassadors of the human beings, of people inside these companies. If you study design in school, they teach you to create the most meaningful and relevant solution to people's needs and wants. This solution could be a product, could be a brand, a service, an experience. It's a solution, in any case, to a need. And this is what we study, what we learn, what we do, what we're passionate about. Then, on top of that, they also tell you, by the way, you also need to make money with it. You need to sell it. But there are many designers that see that part as, you know, a nice to have or something that anyway almost impact the purity, the integrity of the mission of creating value for the world. This is usually what you think at school. Then obviously you grow, you mature, you enter the business world and you understand the importance of the business component. And the business component has been introduced in education, in design education in the past 20, 30 years, and is a pillar of what you study at school. But I mention this because this is the culture of these designers. creating value for people, for the society, for the planet we live in. If you study business instead, they will teach you to grow a business, to build a business, to build a brand, to grow the business once again. Then they will tell you, by the way, you also need a good product, else, you know, as a lever. The product is a lever for another goal, grow a business. So it's a completely different starting point. You're not there to build value for the society. You're there to make money for your company, for yourself. Or it's a different starting point. Then we all meet at the center, because at the end of the day, you want to have a good product that sells. And there is an ethical value of selling as well, because by selling the product, you reach as many people as possible. Those people buying your products are the endorsers of the quality of your product. If there is fair competition and your product is one of many in the market and the best wins. So what I'm trying to say is this. In a world like the one of 20, 30 years ago, where you, the big corporations especially, at the luxury of building huge barrier to entry through distribution, scale of production, huge investment, therefore, in distribution and production, plus the investments in media. So all of those were big barrier to entry. You could protect products and solutions in general, eventually were not ideal. They were not excellent. Today, you can't anymore. Your barrier to entry are down, driven by the fact that anybody can come up with an idea, get access to funding through Kickstarter.com or the proliferation of investments fund available out there. The cost of manufacturing is going down, driven by globalization and new technologies. You go straight to your consumers through the commerce platform, bypassing traditional distribution, and you build your ecosystem of communication through social media, bypassing traditional media platform. So the Giovanni or the Maria on the streets can come up with an idea and compete with Pepsi, with, you know, the big corporations. So either you do something extraordinary for these people, the way you build your brands, you engage with them, or you build new products and new brands of the future, or somebody else will do it on your behalf. And therefore, either you have inside the company people that are totally passionate about creating value for people before anything else, or you will have a problem. Because it's not a world anymore where you think first about your financial goals and then you create something around that. It's a world where you need to think first about people, about human beings, about creating value for them, for the society, for the planet, and then the results will come. It's a little bit extreme as a vision, but it gives you the idea of why designers today are relevant in these companies, because they are the ambassadors of these people. They are the voice of the consumers, the customers, the users inside these organizations with this ingenuity, naivete, purity that is so necessary to do innovation today. Sorry for the long answer, but I gave you a little bit of the overview of our philosophy.
No, and I love it. And I mean, I've never thought about how the barriers to entry, as they've come down, have in a lot of ways made art and commerce come together, or the potential value of that. Because of the need to stand out and create something that is truly unique and special and that people value. Can you share a little bit about, I mean, this is a very big, broad question, but you know, your philosophy around innovation by design. You know, you're talking about anticipating the future, creating for tomorrow. And I feel like so many of us, you know, are having a hard time thinking out into the future right now, especially. How do you do that with your teams currently?
Well, the starting point is this profound curiosity that you need to have for everything is out there. We need to be sort of ethnographers 24/7. When you walk to work, when you drive to work, when you take a trip for business reasons or for personal reasons, when you read a book, when you talk with friends, in anything you do, you need to observe the reality that surrounds you with that naivete of a child, with that curiosity of a child. And also, therefore, with respect for other cultures, for diverse cultures, with passion for that kind of diversity, because you know that in a different way of thinking and a different background, you will enrich yourself. Your perspective plus the perspective of somebody else will build a third perspective that is a new, original perspective that didn't exist before.
one of the greatest outcomes that comes when we bring together a startup and an industry-leading company is this idea of diverse thinking and 1+1=3. I think Mauro does a fantastic job here of showing that you take one idea that is different from your own and bring your lens to it. And that understanding delivers a third idea and opportunity that perhaps you didn't know or expect ahead of time going in. And this is some of the magic of the collaboration between the large company and the small company is by bringing them together, you get unexpected outcomes. It can be disruptive in a very positive way, as well as deliver new growth channels for both players.
And so you need to create a dialogue, a connection, a synergy with anything that surrounds you. Once again, people first, but then you get to people through different platforms, reading, traveling, going to events, and getting out of your comfort zone often, getting over maybe your shyness or your inability to connect with others in specific contexts. So there is a mix of different qualities that I mentioned right now. Curiosity, love for diversity, and the getting out of your comfort zone and being in comfort in the fact that you get out of your comfort zone. Respect, dialogue, all these characteristics are essential to understand where society is going. And then you need to trust your guts as well. You need intuition. You need to imagination, fantasy. You need to take all these insights that you collect daily. Now, you can amplify those insights with data, with artificial intelligence, with additional levers, but those are just additional levers. They are additional platforms. But the base is your wisdom created through your observation as an ethnographer 24/7 for the entirety of your life, looking at your life as a learning journey. I usually say, be a student of life, be a student for life. And so that kind of approach is key to gather all those information. And then from that platform wisdom and knowledge, you jump into the future. And that jump is always a bet. You don't know exactly what the future will be. You need to make a bet. You need to imagine what the future could be. That's why you need that intuition and that imagination and that fantasy. And too many times, many companies in the hunt of certainty, to reduce the risk of innovation, they try to have all the answers today. They rely extensively now on technology and data and historically on consumer research. And you need all of that. But that's the platform. You still need to jump. You still need to take a risk. You still need the intuition, the interpretation of those information, the fantasy, the imagination, the mistakes even of these human beings. There's not a world where machines, data, artificial intelligence will take over the human being. Unless we're so good that we're going to create machines that can completely replace the human being, including the ability to sense, you know, the feelings, the emotions, and even the ability to make mistakes, because we may arrive to the ability to sense and feel an emotion. But eventually machines won't make mistakes. So we need instead all of that. All of that is the magic of the human being. If we create machines that are able to replace all of that, then innovation will be the last of our problems. Because the real problem will be that these machines will be so smart, they will understand the human beings are a virus to this planet. They are a problem to the planet from a machine standpoint. Right. So they won't need us and they will get rid of us. Now, it sounds like science fiction, but obviously science fiction comes often from innovators, futurologists, people that understand when you take something to the extreme, what could be the consequence. So hopefully we never arrive to that moment. If we don't, this means that innovation, you will always need the human being, their emotion, intuition, ability to be wrong as well, to really innovate in a meaningful way.
I love the idea of the mistakes actually being sort of part of the magic formula and the ability to make a guess, follow it, and it'd be wrong, but take you somewhere unexpected. and bring you to a different understanding that might be better than what you originally came up with. One phrase you said in there was the hunt for certainty. And you know, we work with lots and lots of large companies that are trying to innovate in different ways. And we often hit this moment of, well, but how do we know it's going to work? What's my ROI? What is, you know, and all the KPIs and metrics. And I also come from sort of the standpoint that all of that is incredibly important and needs to be baked in. But there is this moment where you get on the platform and have to jump. How do you, as an artist and a design thinker, operate when you certainly have to, you know, respect that part of the business? How do you kind of navigate that, I'll call it business need of certainty?
Look, first of all, because this was, it's been always clear, businesses and mostly investors in these businesses need certainty. And therefore, you need to reduce the risk as much as possible. I realized that the answer to this was not in the project itself. So the answer to this challenge was not in the project itself. When I joined PepsiCo, when I joined 3M 10 years before, this tech innovation company I worked with for 10 years before PepsiCo, in both cases, it became clear that my job was not just the one that everybody was expecting, the one of running projects and running them in the right way. I needed to build the right culture to enable me to run those projects in the proper way. So for instance, talking about what we were just discussing, a culture that tolerates mistakes, a culture that allows the team, not just me, obviously, but the cross-functional team to make mistakes. Processes and tools that help you extracting learnings out of those mistakes. You know, often now there is the trend of, yes, we need a culture of failure, blah, blah, blah. Yes, but if you just have that and you don't have the processes, tools, ability, and capabilities to extract learnings, you're just making mistakes for no reason. They're meaningless mistakes. So you need to make them eventually. You shouldn't call them mistakes or failures. That's one problem that we have as a business community. You know, if you work close to the science community that is very close to our design world, and even in the design world itself, you know that to arrive to one scientific innovation, you need to do many, 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 many experiments. The problem is that in the business world, those experiments are called mistakes, failures, instead of experiments. So how can you build, even in the way we call these experiments, we should call them as they are, experiments instead of mistakes and failures. Now, I'm not naive about this. You therefore need to build a financial algorithm that gives you the possibility to make mistakes. You need to account for the cost of these failures and mistakes or experiments. And you need therefore to have eventually part of your portfolio that supports with its success the experiments. You need to prepare your investors for those experiments. You need to prepare your consumers for those experiments. So my first answer to your question is you need to build that culture so that when they ask you, rightly so, for the ROI, you're going to deal with it. You're going to build as many tools as possible to show the ROI of what you're doing. But starting from that understanding that this may go wrong. It's okay if it goes wrong, as far as, once again, it's part of a strategy. Then, when we talk about ROI, I think we also need to understand what is the value of what you're building through the project, through that activity, holistically. So obviously, the most important ROI at the end of the day is driven by financial metrics, is how you grow your top line, bottom line, gaining market share, you know, the typical business financial metrics. Yes. But there are many other values you may build with that activity. In our world, in the business world, I came up with a series of additional advantages, values, benefits that our design thinking approach is creating. For instance, customer engagement. Customer being for us the Walmart, the Target, the Kroger of the world, or the Marriott, the Starwood, the big hotel chains, so distribution of, you know, in food service, retail. Digital, Amazon, Alibaba, and so on and so forth. So how do you build a different engagement with these customers by building value for them? Then it's consumer engagement, how you're changing the connection, the synergy, the engagement of these consumers with your projects. And maybe, you know, that specific project is not delivering this amazing financial success, but is helping you changing the conversation with your customers or consumers. Is the value of how you're thinking, your culture, your strategy to increase your innovation and your innovation rates? Is the impact on the reputation of the company that helps you attracting new talents? Is the impact on the strategy, or you're reshaping the strategy of your company, you know, in a certain way through certain projects? Is obviously also the impact on cost, productivity. Is the cost of running a project? Is the cost of the product itself compared to the increased perception of value that you're creating? So once again, I'm mentioning a few potential areas of value that are not the traditional ones, but have been very powerful for us to build awareness about the value of this different approach even before we arrive to market with products. I had teams investing in our design capability within the company. So business teams investing in additional designers inside the company just by seeing the value before launching anything. Maybe in the way we engage customers in a completely different way, in a much more strategic way, building relationships that you didn't expect with these customers, because all of a sudden we become strategic consultant of them in areas that we didn't expect and they didn't expect, and changing completely the conversation with them. That's one example.
Yeah, I love it. It's interesting. One of the things that when we've run some, I'll call it more public-facing accelerators, where we're bringing a large industry leader and startups together, the unexpected outcome of that is the employee engagement as well as the constituents, right? There's an energy in the room. They think about the business differently. They think about their jobs differently. And that's before what the core outcome is, right? Which is obviously to increase sales or to launch a product, whatever it might be. But I think you're right. It's sort of being able to think holistically about what the value is of what you're doing and why it can deliver value across the chain.
On that note, Fred, something, you know, quickly that could be insightful. Often they ask me, what is the ROI of the design function? Not of the project, but of the design function. And building on what you just shared, what you just said, it's difficult to extract design out of the work of the company, the project. An example that I always make is very similar to what you just said. Let's say that early on in the process, the design team working together with R&D, with marketing, but let's say that the design team in the specific case is creating an idea that is extraordinary, that is exciting the entire system, that the sales organization is passionate about, and the business team and the CEO, they're all passionate about. Well, at that point, there is a high probability that the company is going to double down on that idea, investing a lot of money to communicate it, investing, you know, in the sales organization to sell it in a different way, with more passion, with more bandwidth, with more resources. So how do you divide, discern, you know, what design did from what at that point the communication team is doing, the sales team is doing? So credit to design to build that excitement. There is ROI, the excitement the design was able to build. But then the result is the work of the cross-functional teams. Everybody's been doing their parts. But if there was not an extraordinary idea at the beginning, you wouldn't have probably the success you had because of the resources the company put behind that initiative. I had many conversations of this kind with design organizations that are giving awards organizations. You know, I've been in the judging panels of these organizations many times. Yeah. When they try to divide the value of the design function inside this company from the value of marketing, R&D, insights, or communication. And you see many awards, especially the ones that are for business, so business design awards, that the most of the winners are startups. Because in big corporations, you always think, oh, of course, they have so much money to push that idea or to, you know, the relationship with the big customers. And you don't see instead how those monies were activated, were unlocked because somebody, an inventor, an innovator inside the organization had an extraordinary idea. Often it's a cross-functional team that had that extraordinary idea to then bring to market. So something to keep in mind when we talk about ROI, you know, what is the value of the magic that happened up front before the machine get excited?
Right. I love it. It's exciting the internal machine, which then leads to the unlock for everything else. One of the other challenges that we've seen is, you know, when you're imagining the future, it's obviously changing so quickly now. Can you talk a little bit about, and whether it's Hilo Life or maybe another project that you've brought to market, but this idea of a quick cycle innovation group and how to take something that you spot and get it to market quickly, whereas in the past, you know, it would take 2 to 3 years to launch something. How are you able to kind of, get your ideas out there and see if they resonate?
Well, it all starts with that idea that I shared earlier of experimenting, testing and learning. So the world is moving very, very fast. And there are projects that, first of all, need to go to market fast. So that's the first need, and you were hinting to that in your question as well. But then there is also the need for some projects that by definition require more time, and the market is not going to change enough to impact those projects, to still gather some learning, to still get insights that can inform those projects. So in our way of working, we have teams that at the center try to figure out the future of the company, the future of society. These visions then, and there are multiple streams of work driven mostly by the three pillars of innovation. So desirability, understanding human needs, wants, and trends. Technology, so we have, you know, R&D working on unlocking technologies that are relevant for our industry. And then there is obviously always the business opportunity. What is the future of Pepsi? How can we leverage the brand in a different way? We see many brands out there that did phenomenal things in their way. Think about Apple, starting from being a computer company to be much more today. So there are these multiple streams of work inside these three different clusters, often overlapping with each other, that go on. And you have projects that are long-term projects. Usually in those projects, you need to have a major, important, defendable, sustainable competitive advantage. Often is a technological advantage. So that's long-term innovation, breakthrough innovation that we keep working on. Then there are some out of this strategy that I mentioned earlier, an output could be an acquisition, or it could be a new venture or a partnership with another company in different formats. So that's a way to move fast, scale up fast in the case of an acquisition, or move fast and building synergy in the case of a new venture or a partnership. And then the last stream of work, and now I go back to your question, is what we call quick cycle innovation. So we have ideas and we start to test them quickly in the market. When we say we go from ideation to market in 6 months, the reality is that we are leveraging the assets of the company. We're leveraging our presence in e-commerce. We're leveraging our R&D and design machine has been thinking about certain things for many years. So we activate something and we can go to market quickly. It happened during the pandemic, for instance, with Driftwell, this drink for relaxation that we developed in record time in the middle of a pandemic. But obviously, we were already working on this idea of anxiety, relaxing through drinks. You mentioned Hilo Snacks. Obviously, it's leveraging know-how that we already have in the company, but we're entering a category where we're not at all the idea of ketogenic diet snacks. And the experiment there, for instance, is not just on the formulation of the product themselves, but it's also on the language that we're using for the brand. The health and wellness category is historically kind of serious, using the same kind of colors and visual cues, light colors, earthy, organic kind of colors, you know, reminding you that kind of word, tonality of the brand, wording, kind of serious, often connected to this idea of health and wellness. They all use the same wording and everything. Hilo Snacks is crazy. I mean, it's like, you know, it's fun and is, you know, very iconic. It's very differentiated. It's cartoonish and it's tricky because it is an experiment completely, you know, by definition, because we are bringing a language that you don't expect in that category. And what is the problem? It's not just lack of familiarity, but it's also how eventually could impact your credibility, your credentials in health and wellness. This is ketogenic diet. It's serious stuff. It's scientific stuff. The pack is all about fun. So we're mixing the two playbooks because we do believe that more and more in the future, the fun playbooks that we have, for instance, in carbonated soft drinks, in Pepsi, Mountain Dew, in 7-Up, or in brands like Doritos, Lay's, Cheetos, we want to bring them to the world of health and wellness. We want health and wellness to be the standard and to be fun for people. So, but we are in a transition moment. We are moving, you know, towards a different kind of world. And so we need to understand when is the right timing. We need to educate through our products. We need to make our mistakes because sometimes we'll be too early with certain things. So quick cycle innovation on top of going to market fast with ideas that we think are strong, drift well during the pandemic, yeah, is also a way to test, check if things make sense. And eventually, for instance, you know, that kind of visual language, oh, it works in this little brand we're launching. Can it work in a health and wellness multi-billion-dollar brand that we have in the portfolio? Let's try. We tested and it worked. So that's what quick cycle innovation is about as well.
I love it. Well, I'll get you out of here on this. I was researching before we had our conversation and saw a couple of days ago you posted on LinkedIn and you said, let's choose to be unicorns every day. And I'd love just to get your perspective on what you meant by that and how you think of unicorns and innovators, perhaps as you described them in your book, The Age of Excellence.
Yeah. Well, I published this book. Unfortunately, for now, it's just in Italian, but we're talking with English publishers. So hopefully in the future, we'll be in English as well. But the book is nothing else than the translation of my life journey in the world of innovation. And not just innovation in business, but innovation in life, the way you manage your life and everything. And, you know, when you talk about innovation, most of the times, books, conferences, podcasts, meeting rooms in corporations, in startups, people talk about technology, new products, processes, tools. And the reality is that this is all valuable. This is all important, but they are just platforms. They are levers. They are tools by definition. And when you look at the same processes and tools, maybe in your own company, in different projects with different teams, or when you look out there at different companies, you see that there are some of these projects that fail and some that succeed. Same processes, same tools, same approach. So you're like, wow, there must be something else on top of the processes and tools. And the answer is pretty obvious if you think about it, even though then in companies, we don't talk enough about this. The answer is that the difference is driven by the people behind those tools and processes. In different ways, is the questions that they ask themselves, is their ability to identify the primary causes, the root causes of everything. Not just answering a brief that you receive, but deeply understanding what the brand, the company, the world, the society needs. Many people don't arrive to the primary cause. They stop to the first why, to the first questions, without asking again why and why and why and why again. Yeah. Many people receive the brief for redesigning a bridge, and then we redesign the bridge in a wonderful way, beautiful, very functional, technically, you know, amazing, amazing technologies. But they won't ask themselves, why do I even need a bridge? You know, what is the cause? And the cause may be that you want to move from A to B and there is a river in the middle. And so maybe the solution, the innovative solution, is not a new bridge, but is the invention of a boat, of an helicopter, the invention of something that never existed before. Or maybe if you ask again why, you will find out that maybe people don't need to move from A to B. Maybe you can deliver that experience in A. And the solution is to redesign A in a different way instead of designing a bridge. So this is what innovation is about. And you need, therefore, the right people that ask the right questions. There is no tool for that. You need the right mindset. And then once you have the right questions, you need the right solutions. Now, yes, you may redesign what happened in A, but there are many ways of redesigning what happened in A. So the answers, the quality of the answers is also something unique and is driven by people, their intuition, their imagination, their creativity, many qualities. And finally, even when you have the right answer, you need them people to have the courage to go to market with that answer, the resilience to fight for it, the optimism to believe in it. So these are the unicorns. These are people that are difficult to find. That's why I call them the unicorns. They're almost, you know, mythological. In fact, in the book, I created a long list of the characteristics of these people, of these innovators. And I know perfectly that there is nobody in the planet that has all the characteristics to the extreme. In fact, my message is that we need to spend our life as, once again, student of life, students for life, learning, bettering ourselves, tending to be the kind of unicorn that is nothing else than an idea, to say it with Plato, you know, the ideal world of Plato, the philosopher. And there are many characteristics, the more traditional one, the ability to have a vision and to dream and to execute, the ability to prototype and experiment, but many that are unexpected. I talk about goodness of soul, being a good human being, and I link it to productivity and efficiency inside these organizations, because I know if I just talk about being good, it sounds like a very nice and romantic idea, but nobody cares. But if you link it to business value, then everybody's like, oh, wait a second. And there is. Good people are more efficient for a variety of different ways. That could be another podcast. optimism, resilience, respect, the value of respect to drive innovation in a world where you need to team with others to build cross-functional activities. So respect is key, dialogue, love for diversity. So all these characteristics that define the people that make the difference. And then we talk about, you know, can you mentor them? Can you train them? Is it a talent that you have, or is something that you may nurture and create? And again, the reality is that partially is a talent that you have, like if you are an amazing soccer player, an amazing football player or tennis player, you or an artist, you have, you know, many people have that talent when they're born with a talent. But if you don't train that talent, right, you won't become Maradona or Agassi or whatever is the star, the sports star that you, or the artist that you love. And if you don't have the amazing talent of a superstar, but you train your basic talent, there is a high chance that you can perform better than the natural born unicorn that doesn't train and maintain and practice his talent. So there is a message of positivity for everybody that I really believe in. You need talent. The one that have these born talents have an advantage for sure. But you need also hard work and practice and then resilience to really take that talent to the next level, no matter what is your starting point.
That's great. Well, where is a good place for people to go to learn more about your work and follow you? And I have to say, I've been on LinkedIn following your posts of the work the design team is doing. And it's just, it's beautiful. It's art. I mean, the Thailand 7-Up cans were, I mean, you'd wanted to put them up on your walls. They were so gorgeous. So just curious, is LinkedIn a good place to follow you, or where would you like to direct the audience?
Well, I am very, very active, daily active in three platforms. My favorite one is Instagram because of the nature of the platform. Mauro Porcini in Instagram is the one where I post the most. Then the second one at the same level, Facebook and LinkedIn. They're all complementary to each other because they have different rules of engagement. So if you follow me in the three platforms, you will get the most content. Yes, I'm very active in all of them. But Instagram, literally at least a post a day and multiple stories a day. So there is a lot.
Great. Well, I'll start following you there and encourage everyone else to. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I could have gone on for hours. When we get your book in English, let me know. We'll pump it out there to everybody.
Hopefully soon. Thanks, Fred, for the interest and the opportunity of talking with you and the people listening to us today.
Thanks so much for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, please click subscribe as well as go to LinkedIn and follow at VentureFuel. This is where we share all sorts of insights around industry-leading startups, innovators like Moro, who are rethinking the future, as well as let you know about upcoming events and opportunities. Until next time.